Good morning, everyone. I'm Rob Stefanik, the Secretary of the Department of Parliamentary Services, and on behalf of the Parliamentary Librarian, Dr. Diane Herriot, and myself, I'd like to welcome you to the annual Parliamentary Library National Reconciliation Week lecture. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today. I acknowledge and pay my respects to their elders past and present and future, and pay my respects to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here with us today, including, of course, our esteemed guest speaker. Can I now please ask Violet Sheridan to provide the welcome to country?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to perform the welcome to country. It's been a busy week. National Reconciliation Week is a time for all Australians to reflect and celebrate the contribution and achievements of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. This year's theme is Don't Keep History a Mystery. And Reconciliation Australia have invited Australians to learn, share and grow by learning more about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander histories, peoples, cultures and developing an understanding of our shared history. The 27th of May marked the anniversary of our most successful referendum, the 1967, a defining event in our nation's history. The referendum saw over 90% of Australians vote to give the Commonwealth the power to make laws for my people and to recognise them in the census. To me, I was about 12 year old then, it actually did nothing for us, but actually gave the government, I feel, more power to control us. As we look back on historical and momentum events, we also must look forward and ask ourselves, what are we doing to progress reconciliation today? My first encounter was reconciliation. I used to live in on a little Aboriginal reserve up the northwest, which was called Waholo. And I used to travel to work every day, about 90 k's a day, about 100 k's a day it was, up and back. So I was very interested in reconciliation at that time, and they used to have little subcommittees. They started off having little subcommittees in towns. So that was the only closest town that had a subcommittee, so I joined the reconciliation group then. That was my first encounter with reconciliation. But I also started to work for the New South Wales Aboriginal Lands Council, which invited us all down to Sydney back in 2000. I thought, okay, I'll go along. There won't be probably many people there. But I looked back when I walked over that Sydney Harbour Bridge back in 2000, and there were streams and streams of people. It just shocked me how many people was there. And I felt that was the start of reconciliation. But we as peoples, whether Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal people, to walk into the future with reconciliation. To me, Don't Keep History a Mystery is about we as Australians and as Aboriginal people, you need to acknowledge that Australia's had a past, and it wasn't a very nice past, particularly with Aboriginal people. So if you hear people telling stories, because there is hidden stories there that need to be told for us to accept that and acknowledge that, and then we need to walk both black and white into the future, because I've got 18 grannies, which I brought two along this morning with me, and I'm a great-grandmother. I'd like to see that is changed a lot. It's got much better reconciliation, but the only ones that's going to make it work is that we as people, Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people, accept that Australia's had a past, and it wasn't a very nice past. And stories will be told, and some people will get offended. But we need to tell those stories and acknowledge those stories for us to move forward as a nation. Well, to just have a good holiday, particularly if those ones that live in Canberra, isn't it? So we as a territory, I would love to see other states and territories adapt the holiday, reconciliation holiday around the state. But we, being Canberra, we always have to lead. We're such a good territory. The public holiday will provide Canberrians to learn not just about history, but about how all Australians can contribute to reconciliation as our nation. This year's event is a great example of how our nation can come together to celebrate and promote. So if you're familiar with the 26th of May, mark the Sorry Day. So the 3rd of June will mark Mabo Day, which paved the way for native title, which got rid of that awful word, terra nullius. So to me, a welcome to country is a traditional Aboriginal blessing, symbolising the traditional owner's consent for an event taking place on the land. And it also shows respect for the First Peoples of the land you are entering. I suppose it's a little bit about not going into someone else's home unless you're invited or welcomed. None of all people have conducted ceremonies on these lands for many years. My people have danced on what is known as the Yaktal Peninsula, home of the National Museum the place known as Black Mountain. These areas are rich with traditions from our ancient rock heart in the Imagine National Park. It is important for us all to acknowledge and to recognise our unique histories, and again an understanding that the loss of land, that the land is our heritage, and how the loss of land has disconnected many Indigenous peoples from the spiritual links, cultures and identity. And I believe that is why a lot of our young people are incarcerated today. We've lost our identity, we've lost our heritage and culture, but we need to get back that as elders to start reaching out and teaching our young people. I would like to pay my respects to my elders, past and emerging, and extend that respect to other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the room. I'd also like to acknowledge all the non-Aboriginal people in the room, and particularly the Secretariat, she's there. In keeping the general spirit of friendship reconciliation, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here this morning on behalf of my people who are the traditional owners of the land that you sleep, breathe and work on, so look after it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Violet. On behalf of the heads of the four parliamentary departments, I'd like to briefly mention our commitment to reconciliation as expressed through the Australian Parliamentary Service Reconciliation Action Plan. Our vision for reconciliation is a commitment to build understanding and respect amongst our Australian Parliamentary Service staff for the histories and living cultures of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their contribution to Australian life. Through this, we can contribute to reconciliation in Australia. Today's event represents another small step. Our guest speaker today is Professor Megan Davis. Professor Davis is a Kobal Kobal woman from a Barunga Nation in southwest Queensland and is also of Pacific Islander descent. She's been at the forefront of advancing Indigenous recognition and self-determination in Australia and worldwide throughout her career, and is one of Australia's leading constitutional lawyers. Professor Davis studied arts and law at the University of Queensland, finishing her law degree in Geneva on a UN scholarship. After graduating, she worked for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission and at the UN, where she contributed to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and became a fellow of the UN High Commission on Human Rights. On her return to Australia, she completed a PhD at the Regulatory Institutions Network at the ANU while working as Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales. In 2010, she became the first Indigenous Australian to be elected to a UN body when she became Australia's representative at the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Affairs. And in 2011, she was nominated a member of the Prime Minister's Expert Panel on Constitutional Recognition of Indigenous Peoples. In 2015, she was elected chair of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Affairs and also became a member of Prime Minister Turnbull's Referendum Council, which, over a two-year period, oversaw the nationwide consultation process leading up to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. She's a fellow of the Academy of Social Science in Australia and Australian Academy of Law and a recipient of numerous rewards for service to the United Nations, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, and the Australian community as a whole. Professor Davis is currently Professor of Law and Pro Vice-Chancellor Indigenous at the University of New South Wales expert advisor to the UN Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous People, and acting commissioner of the New South Wales Land and Environment Court. And that's not all. Professor Davis has a great love of the game of rugby league and is an Australian Rugby League commissioner. Those of you who follow her on Twitter, at mdavisqlder, may have picked up that she supports the North Queensland Cowboys and the Queensland Cane Toads, the Maroons. She is the co-author with Professor George Williams of Everything You Need to Know About the Referendum to Recognise Indigenous Australians, and co-author with Professor Marcia Langton of It's Our Country, Indigenous Arguments for Meaningful Arguments for Constitutional Recognition and Reform. As you can see, Professor Davis has a formidable CV, and in the interests of allowing her time to speak, we had to leave quite a lot out. 2018 marks 30 years since Galarrwuy Yunupingu and Mr Rabuncha presented the then Prime Minister Bob Hawke with a statement of Indigenous political objectives at the Barunga Festival in the Northern Territory. What became known as the Barunga Statement called for Indigenous self-management, a national system of land rights, compensation for loss of lands, respect for Aboriginal identity, an end to discrimination, and the granting of full civil, economic, social and cultural rights. Prime Minister Hawke's reception of the Barunga Statement significantly contributed to his advocacy for a Makarrata, or Treaty with Aboriginal Australia. While the Hawke government was unable to achieve general support for a treaty, it achieved cross-party support for a process of national reconciliation. This was led between 1991 and 2000 by the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, which was led by current Senator for Western Australia, Pat Dodson, among others. Since 2000, the work of the Council has been carried forward by Reconciliation Australia. Some of you may have been here two nights ago when we commemorated the 30th anniversary of the Barunga Statement, which was presented to Parliament House by Bob Hawke in his final act as Prime Minister and is now on public view in the first floor gallery. Professor Davis will speak today on the significance of the Barunga Statement in relation to the historic Uluru Statement from the Heart and the work of the Aboriginal Constitutional Dialogues in designing a framework of reform to address disadvantage and commence a process of reconciliation. I now invite Professor Davis to take the microphone. Thank you, Professor Davis.
I might take my shoes off, actually. Just get comfortable. Thanks for that kind introduction. You really only had to announce the Australian Rugby League Commission part, but I'm grateful for all the other academic stuff. As a Kobble Kobble woman from the Barangam Nation in southwest Queensland, I wanted to begin by thanking Aunty Violet, who's somewhere at the back or has left. Oh, no, you haven't. You're just there. Come on. Cowboys are just as good as the Rabbitohs, you know that. Well, not this year, but we will win against Manly tonight and we will forge on to the finals. Anyway, my niece is going like this, saying you're embarrassing me, Arnie, so I'll begin properly by also acknowledging country on where we meet today and pay my respects to the ancestors and their elders past and present. And again, thank you, Aunty Violet. I've been doing a few National Reconciliation Week talks this week, of course. I don't normally do them, but I found them really fascinating. I think the theme has been incredible, a really clever, clever theme. Don't keep history a mystery. But also the elders in all of their welcomes have been extraordinary. And one of the things that I think has really shifted in Australia, as someone who's a published cynic on reconciliation, is that our elders and our people feel comfortable about talking about their discomfort with the reconciliation process, and I think that's been really important this year. It's a noticeable difference. I also wanted to... So thank you for that introduction and the organisers for asking me to deliver this 2018 Parliamentary Library Reconciliation Lecture. So I've been asked to speak about the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and to that end, I'll just acknowledge the presence of Aunty Pat Anderson, who is in the room today, who was the key driver and key leader of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, the 13 Dialogues, and the National Constitutional Convention. Without her diplomacy, I'm not sure we would have achieved what we achieved, but I just wanted to acknowledge that you're here. She was the co-chair of the Referendum Council with Mark Liebler. So I'm going to speak about the Uluru Statement in the context of the Barunga Statement. So it's the 30th anniversary of the Barunga Statement and the first anniversary of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And of course, as Arnie Violet alluded to, the 51st anniversary of the 1967 referendum. So what do each of these political and legal statements, one 30 years old and one that is barely 1 year old, say about reconciliation and Australian democracy? That's what I wanted to talk about today. As I said, I don't normally accept National Reconciliation Week speech requests, and partly because my scholarly work has been oriented towards criticism of Australia's reconciliation process. So globally, if I put my UN hat on, you see reconciliation processes in countries with significant Indigenous populations, whereby that process begins with a truth-telling. It doesn't need to be a truth commission. It doesn't need to be a big televised, you know, national truth commission. But there is truth-telling. It's called truth and reconciliation. And one of my critiques has always been that Australia skipped the truth-telling part or process and tried to move directly to reconciliation. And I think this explains the slow process of reconciliation in Australia. And reconciliation can't be confused either with assimilation, for which it often is too easily done in Australia. So, thanks, mate. Thank you. So I want to do three things today. First, I'll say a few words about the Barunga Statement. Then I will speak about the Uluru process in more depth because it's contemporaneous and I was involved in that. And because at the very heart of the Uluru Statement is a roadmap for peace. Uluru is about peace and it's about reconciliation. And then I'll conclude with some brief observations on both statements and reconciliation. But let me begin by reading the Barunga Statement. We, the Indigenous owners and occupiers of Australia, call on the Australian government and people to recognise our rights. Our rights to self-determination and self-management, including the freedom to pursue our own economic, social, religious and cultural development. To permanent control and enjoyment of our ancestral lands. To compensation for the loss of the use of our lands, there having been no extinction of original title. To protection of and control of access to our sacred sites, sacred objects, artefacts, designs, knowledge and works of art. To the return of the remains of our ancestors for burial in accordance with our traditions. To respect for and promotion of our Aboriginal identity, including the cultural, linguistic, religious and historical aspects, and including the right to be educated in our own languages and in our own culture and history. In accordance with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Rights to life, liberty, security of person, food, clothing, housing, medical care, education, and employment opportunities, necessary social services, and other basic rights. We call on the Commonwealth to pass laws providing a national elected Aboriginal and Islander organisation to oversee Aboriginal and Islander affairs. A national system of land rights. A police and justice system which recognises our customary laws and frees us from discrimination and any activity which may threaten our identity or security, interfere with our freedom of expression or association, or otherwise prevent our full enjoyment and exercise of universally recognised human rights and fundamental freedoms. We call on the Australian Government to support Aborigines in the development of an international declaration of principles for Indigenous rights, leading to an international covenant. And we call on the Commonwealth Parliament to negotiate with us a treaty, recognising our prior ownership, continued occupation and sovereignty, and affirming our human rights and freedom. That is the Barunga Statement that was issued 30 years ago. Senator Patrick Dodson over the weekend, someone I was very privileged to serve with on the 2011 Prime Minister's Expert Panel and initially the 2015-17 Referendum Council, drew a comparison over the weekend between Barunga and Uluru. Effectively, he said, beware of promises from politicians. They commit to things that they aren't really committed to. He said, Hawke promised treaty. He came back to Canberra and it never happened. And look at us 30 years later. We certainly are patient people. The Barunga Festival, the annual cultural and sporting festival, was hosted in 1988 by the Jawin community, and that year the two chairs of the Northern Land Council and the Central Land Council attended. And on the 12th of June, the Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, was presented with the Barunga Statement by the two chairs. So this was a statement, a declaration, a petition presented on a bark painting. The statement was the culmination of years of discussion between Aboriginal groups in the Northern Territory and also the Commonwealth. The Prime Minister responded to this by saying that he wished to conclude a treaty between Aboriginals and other Australians by 1990. In his speech, before presenting Barunga, the chair of the NLC, Galarrwuy Yunupingu, declared, "The notice that we will present to the Prime Minister now will remind not only Bob Hawke, but the next one after him, and the next one after him, and the next one after him, and the one after him, and we can count that for another 20 to 100 years, and after, and more after, and forever." We know that the Barunga Statement has been on permanent exhibition here in Parliament House since about 1991, I think. And we know that Bob Hawke never delivered on that treaty. Barunga today is the stuff of legend. As I said, the form it was delivered in a bark painting, hangs on these walls, most of the demands unimplemented. So initially I thought Patrick's comparison didn't quite hold up because Bob Hawke said there would be a treaty and Prime Minister Turnbull said there will be no Uluru. There's a significant difference between the two. But on reflection, I think that Patrick has a point, but I'll return to that at the end and the significance of Barunga in the context of Uluru after I speak about Uluru. So Patrick, pre-politics, was part of a delegation, including myself, Noel Pearson, and one of the co-chairs of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, Kirsty Parker, who visited Prime Minister Abbott in 2015, where we raised our genuine concerns with him and his government that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had disengaged with the recognition process, with constitutional recognition. Anyone who surveys Aboriginal media, social media, works in Aboriginal communities, or new Aboriginal people would have seen that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were turning against a process that they saw was going to culminate in what they call symbolic recognition. They were concerned that the government was hurtling toward a referendum to symbolically recognise Aboriginal people. And I think it's not controversial anymore to make the point that the recognise campaign that had been set up by the government to promote education on the purpose or the exigency of constitutional recognition actually had the reverse effect in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. One of the biggest problems we had as a referendum council in our dialogues was convincing the mob that we weren't the recognised campaign. So our delegation went to the Prime Minister and said, we have to do a proper process. We have to ask Aboriginal people what they want because this has not been done yet. So you can roughly say, some people say recognition started in 1999 with Howard and the preamble. Others say 2011 with the expert panel. But certainly if it was 2011 with the expert panel, by 2015 there had been no comprehensive conversation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people about what recognition might mean to them. The referendum council did what the expert panel did not do, and I was a member of both, but the referendum council elicited a clear indication from First Nations what they wanted or what they want in constitutional recognition. What is meaningful recognition to the First Nations? So the expert panel did engage with some communities. We had quite small meetings across the country with some Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. But what came out of that was two things, and I think this is a really important thing to remember from the expert panel to the referendum council. What the expert panel did was devote two chapters to treaty and sovereignty in 2011. They were the two topics that communities wanted to speak about, treaty and sovereignty. We made the decision on the basis of our criteria about successful referendums that we wouldn't progress either of those, but I think it's really important if we're learning to hear what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people say, is that that was a red flag then in the expert panel. The mob wanted to talk about those two things. We as an expert panel, we chose the reform options. It was we who chose them, and then we shopped them out to the Australian people. So to his credit, the new Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, heard what we were saying about constitutional recognition and agreed to set up this referendum council. Recognition is not an easy process in any country with significant Indigenous populations. It's not an ordinary process at all. It's no simple law reform. We know that constitutional reform is difficult anyway in Australia, but this is more difficult even than that. And I say that because it involves two parties. It involves the recognisor, the Australian people, and it involves the to be recognised. And you must have the to be recognised agreeing with the reform, or it's not recognition. And Professor Cheryl Saunders from the University of Melbourne often says, you know, they can go ahead and do minimalist or symbolic reforms if they wish, and they can do it without the agreement of First Nations, but they just can't call it recognition. You can't call it constitutional recognition. Recognition was chosen for whatever reason. It's the word that is used in the context of political and legal or political science and law as it pertains to the accommodation of Indigenous populations in Western liberal democracies. But it can mean multiple things. So it can mean a preamble, but it can also mean substantive reform to power relations. It can mean both of those things. So recognition can mean a treaty, reserved or designated parliamentary seats. It can mean an Indigenous parliament. It can mean a voice to the parliament. It can mean a non-discrimination clause, or it can mean a statement of recognition. It can be any of those things. And so I guess in the absence of the government over a period of 7 years never really saying what recognition they were interested in, then the public discussion in Australia has rarely risen above the dictionary meaning of recognition, and that is acknowledgement. And I guess this, the notion that this was just about acknowledgement, was unsettling for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So in the absence of a very clear model, very clear direction, the advocacy for recognition was conflated with a very minimal and symbolic form. So prior to Prime Minister Turnbull taking the Prime Ministership, Prime Minister Abbott hosted a council of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders at Kirribilli House. That was in mid-2015. And I'm going to make this point because I think it's very important to understanding Uluru as well. So we went to Abbott, we said there's a big problem. He said, okay, and he called in 40 leaders. Out of that meeting, or at that meeting, there was a caucus, a universal consensus across the country from leaders of the following. Any reform must involve substantive changes to the Australian Constitution. It must lay the foundation for the fair treatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples into the future. A minimalist approach that provides preambular recognition, removes Section 25 and moderates the race power does not go far enough and would not be acceptable to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. That is the core cultural leadership mid-2015, before the council was set up and before the council runs its dialogues. So expert panel, mob is saying treaty and sovereignty. Mid-2015, after we were really concerned that we were just losing completely Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander engagement on this issue, this is what leaders said. They will not accept a minimalist approach. I just park that because of the comments post Uluru that it was unexpected what was done there. So the Kirribilli leaders recommended an ongoing dialogue between the Australian government and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, because at that point, discussions amongst ourselves was about the absence of a step of negotiations. So in any process, you don't get 100% of what you want. You know that you have to compromise and you know you have to engage in negotiations. And it didn't look like that process was being built in. Rather, the Parliament would decide what the amendment was and then it would go forward from there. Negotiations are a really key part of that. At least for us, as we have studied those overseas processes that also have engaged in constitutional recognition. So although he was advised that our communities were over-consulted, to his credit, Turnbull did set up the referendum council. So I'll say a few words about this process before I explain what we did, because it really is quite an innovative constitutional process that I'm, and I speak for Aunty Pat too, I think, that really proud of the reforms that the mob agreed to or settled on at Uluru. So the road to Uluru involved a trial dialogue with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, so we couldn't go out and consult, we couldn't do consultations. So this was about 4 years, 3 years post Indigenous Advancement Strategy. Communities really were not in a very nice mood when we turned up, and they did not want to engage in consultations, meaning we just come out, talk, PowerPoint, you know, pages, what do you want, write it down, go back. We actually studied a lot of deliberative decision-making processes around the world, including Indigenous ones, because we wanted to engage in a process that allowed people to feel that it was bottom-up and not top-down. So it wasn't a proposal being imposed on them, but they were contributing to this law reform. So the consultation process that we undertook, the initial one with the traditional owners and the leaders and the organisations, that was approved of by the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. So they knew about the trial dialogue and they knew about the preparatory work. Then the Prime Minister and opposition leader approved our dialogue process. So they approved our 13 dialogues and they approved all of the reforms that we took out to the communities. So the Prime Minister and opposition leader agreed to the inclusion of a voice to the Parliament and a treaty, because we said we couldn't go out there. Victoria's negotiating a treaty, we can't not talk about the elephant in the room. They agreed to that. The plan of the consultations and the dialogue was also provided to the Indigenous Affairs Minister, Nigel Scullion. So we know that the expert panel in 2011 and the Joint Select Committee over about a two-year period undertook widespread face-to-face consultations with the general Australian public. The expert panel too, the bulk of their consultations were with the general Australian public. They had over 5,000 submissions and the bulk were non-Indigenous. So the referendum council decided to distinguish its process from the expert panel and the Joint Select Committee, and we decided that we needed to undertake these dialogues so that we could ascertain a majority view from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So this is the process of ascertaining from the to be recognised what is meaningful recognition to you. and we wanted to design it so that we got a sample of voices from across the country, from all corners of the country, so that everybody had been, or at least a sample of mobs had been engaged. The council, decided it wasn't practicable to undertake a deliberative process with the entire Australian population. That was not expected of the Republic referendum, where a deliberative process did occur, but it was selected and elected. So it was the council's assessment that the position of the general Australian public would be represented in the conventional way, and that is submissions to the referendum council. Then the position of the general Australian public would be represented by the elected parliamentarians who would need to legislate a referendum proposal, and ultimately the Australian people vote through a referendum. At our dialogues, all referendum council members were invited to attend, and non-Indigenous council member Michael Rose attended several of the dialogues, and many non-Indigenous constitutional lawyers were involved in the process as well. So as I said, the dialogue process involved us talking to people and asking people what they want through a very structured process rather than consultation. So we went to Broome, Thursday Island and Melbourne first to seek permission from our traditional owners about the process. So we walked them through the entire process. As I said, the entire plan had been endorsed by the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. It was important for us procedurally to get that letter of okay from the Prime Minister and Shorten to ensure that what we were taking to our TOs, to these preparatory meetings, had been agreed to. We would run these dialogues, culminating in a final one in the centre of the country at Uluru. All of the key Aboriginal organisations and Torres Strait Islander organisations were involved in this process. IAXIS, the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, were engaged to help us deliver the logistics and support delegates to attend. So we as a council didn't run them. IAXIS engaged local land councils to run them. So we needed to stay arm's length as a referendum council. The First Nations regional dialogues were convened by the following Aboriginal orgs: in Hobart by the Tasmanian Aboriginal Corporation, in Broome by the Kimberley Land Council, in Dubbo by the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, in Darwin by the Northern Land Council, in Perth, the Southwest Aboriginal Land and Sea Council, in Sydney, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, in Melbourne, the Federation of Victorian Traditional Owners Corporation, who are leading the treaty process there, in Cairns by the North Queensland Land Council, in Ross River by the Central Land Council, in Adelaide by the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, in Brisbane by a number of organisations, and similarly in Thursday Island, hosted by the Torres Shire Council, the Torres Strait Regional Authority, and a number of Torres Strait regional organisations. A truncated version was hosted by the United Ngunnawal Elders Council here in Canberra on the 10th of May. And then finally, a three-day national constitutional convention held at Uluru. So we, as the referendum council at least, say that this process is unprecedented in Australian history. It's the first time that an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander constitutional convention has been convened with and for First Nations. We spoke to just over 1,200 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, so it was about 100 from each dialogue, although a lot of people, for example in Cairns, you had a huge turn-up of people watching. So we say, and this is a direct quote, that this is the most proportionally significant consultation process that has ever been undertaken with First Peoples. Indeed, it gauged a greater proportion of the relevant population than the constitutional convention debates of the 1800s, from which First Peoples were excluded. As I've already alluded to, the process was structured and principled. We looked at a lot of processes across the world. We did a lot of research on the way in which constitutional changes that happen at territory, state and Commonwealth levels here in Australia. We settled to some extent on the constitutional centenary foundation framework that had been used in the 1990s to encourage debate I'm in local communities and schools on constitutional issues. So we adapted a lot of the methodology from that to the First Nations dialogues. So impartiality, accessibility of relevant information, open and constructive dialogue, and mutually agreed and owned outcomes. So at the end of all of the dialogues, we had a record of meeting and everybody signed off on it. So in terms of the invitation list, not everyone could attend, of course. We didn't have the money to hold big meetings. So we had a structured criteria. 60% were drawn from our First Nations, so that our traditional owner groups. So it was very important to us that the cultural authority of our countries was represented in each of the dialogues. So 60% came from traditional owner groups. And that's primarily why IATSIS auspiced the land councils to run the dialogues. 20% came from the way we organise ourselves, so Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community organisations, so local grassroots communities, community organisations. And 20% was key individuals, so just people who were interested. Stolen generations were really important to us to attend. You know, a lot of grannies would turn up, a lot of elders, a lot of young people. So there was quite a variety of just key individuals who attended. And that's how that's how each of the dialogues run. And so that's why we're very confident that it is the process that led to the consensus at Uluru. So we didn't allow filming. So there was some visual filming at times, but we did not allow anything to be recorded because the levels of trust were so low. We often couldn't allow Prime Minister and Cabinet in the room. Because of the huge animosity that's felt in communities towards the department. And the department was running our process, so often they would have to sit in another room. So we had to create this space where people would talk frankly to us in a way that, although they knew it was being recorded in the record of meetings, that they would agree to that. But we weren't doing things like taking footage. Mostly people did not want any media attention. It was done very low-key in a way, I suppose, to engender trust in the process. So each of the dialogues spoke about the reforms that the Prime Minister and the opposition leader agreed to. We would go through civics to begin with, so a lengthy kind of civics DVD that explained the constitution, the parliament, the judiciary. So we walked through for a couple of hours, civics. We also walked through the history of Aboriginal Australia from first contact, invasion, frontier killings, the protection era, self-determination, and showed examples of the way in which the law can oppress people, but ways in which the law also redeems. So we used multiple examples of the way the High Court or legislation had led to significant developments in Indigenous rights. We had local leaders who would facilitate meetings with constitutional lawyers, facilitate working groups with constitutional lawyers. There was very high level of engagement. They were very intense meetings. They involved assessment of legal and political viability. So often when people say, what happened to non-discrimination 116A, we would have to talk about political viability. So we kind of ran a ruler of multiple things across the reforms before people prioritised what they thought was the most important thing to them and their region, because it was very regionally based. And to that end, I would just say here, I give so much credit. I really take my hat off to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander mums and dads and young people and grannies and elders and traditional owners who gave up 3 days of their time, including their weekends. Well, it was mostly their weekends, actually, to speak with us about the Constitution, because it's not a very exciting topic, as Honey Pat knows. It sends everybody to sleep. But we also had to build in an extra day of deliberation that we didn't expect to because of the anger and disappointment and hurt that people were feeling across the country about this process, about their powerlessness and their feelings of voicelessness. So that was something we didn't expect. But we did build that in, and that extra day is actually where this idea of truth-telling emerged from across the regions. And truth-telling was one proposal that we didn't, was never on the table, we didn't get permission to take it out, but it was so overwhelming in terms of this desire of Aboriginal Australia wanting the rest of Australia to know our stories, that we felt we couldn't ignore it and we had to include it in the reforms. So other than that, we distilled guiding principles that emerged from all of the dialogues. So things that people said, when we finish with the referendum council, when it goes to government and when there's negotiations around what that looks like, there has to be guiding principles. And every law reform proposal has to have this rule of run against them. And that those proposals, or those guiding principles, are informed by the Bark petitions of 1963, the Barunga Statement of 1988, the Eva Valley Statement of 1993, the Kalkaringi Statement of 1998, the Social Justice Package of 1995, and the Kirribilli Statement of 2015. So those five guiding principles as we move forward are: any proposal can't diminish Aboriginal sovereignty and Torres Strait Islander sovereignty. Any constitutional reform must involve substantive structural reform. Communities were adamant that the change must lead to change, that it couldn't be just a gesture where people say to us, 20 years down the track, your health's going to get better because you're going to feel better about yourself. People want structural reform where they can see that it will actually make a pragmatic difference to their lives on the ground. Three, it must advance self-determination. Four, it must recognise the status of First Nations. Five, it must tell the truth of history. Six, it can't foreclose on future advancements. Seven, it can't waste the opportunity of reform. Eight, it must provide a mechanism for First Nations agreement making. Nine, it has to have the support of the First Nations. And 10, it can't interfere with positive legal arrangements. So as I start to wrap up, the Uluru Statement, or at least the Uluru reforms, called for what we call voice, treaty and truth. So in this week of National Reconciliation, we say the Uluru Statement was a call for peace, and the proposal is a roadmap to peace. We considered the expert panel models, the Joint Select Parliamentary Committee. We got permission from the Prime Minister to take out two additional options. Every single working group in the dialogues endorsed the voice to Parliament as a reform priority. In addition to that, they came up with a reform that no constitutional lawyer had even conceived of until the dialogues. They designed this voice in a way that it would operate as a front-end political limit on the Parliament's power to pass laws that affect Aboriginal people under Section 5126 and under Section 122. So while people appreciated that this model would not guarantee that these powers would not be used against them in the future in a negative, adverse, discriminatory way, because, of course, constitutionally you can't create a veto right. So we had these discussions in the dialogues about what this front-end political limit would look like and how different it is to taking a court-centred rights approach. But people felt that it would create a limit through political empowerment. And they felt that that political empowerment, although limited, would hopefully achieve better designed policies in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities in the future. So that roadmap to peace was a constitutional voice, a Makarrata Commission, and truth-telling. And as my colleague on the council, Galarrwuy Yunupingu, said, Makarrata is the future, but it is based on a truthfulness about the past. We have legitimate grievances, and these grievances need to be carefully worked out and then resolved. So the process of Makarrata has only just started. The aggrieved party has just called the party that it alleges has done it wrong to come forward and meet with it. So the Uluru Statement is in fact a sign of friendship. Many of our old people are dying and they want some peace for their country. So the Uluru Convention saw the delegates come together and adopt a consensus position on constitutional reform, and we issued the Uluru Statement from the heart. And we issued that to the Australian people on purpose, and this is what brings me back to Barunga. We issued it to the Australian people and not to politicians because of the Barunga statement and other statements and petitions that are handed to politicians and then end up being hung on walls of institutions. We felt very strongly that the only way that we are going to move forward on constitutional recognition is if we first work with Australians to explain what we're doing, explain why we're doing it, and why we need the help of all Australia to push these reforms forward. We've had an overwhelming response from Australians from the Uluru Statement from the Heart, because they too, as Australians, recognise the limitations of ballot box liberal democracy. They understand the frustrations that we have with law reform inertia and policy inertia. They understand the concerns we have about our children and child protection and youth detention and our high rates, world level rates of incarceration. And so we've been really, I think, warmed by the way Australians have stepped up to the plate to help build a campaign with us to shift these reforms forward. So the outcome was very clear. The proposal for a First Nations constitutional voice was not only supported by a strong majority of mob at the dialogues and at Uluru, it was supported by the majority of submissions received from the general Australian public. Two sets of polling have also shown 61% in Omnipoll and 57% in Newspoll, both in the face of government opposition to the voice proposal, that Australians support this proposal. We also adopted a technique called a constitutional decision to defer. We've deferred the decisions around what that body looks like to the Parliament as a nod to parliamentary sovereignty. The Referendum Council has asked elected parliamentary representatives to work with Indigenous people to produce the legislative detail, as is their political responsibility. We have also asked the Parliament to put the voice proposal to the Australian people, so that we can have access to the Australian people's views on this. So to sum up, Barunga and Uluru and reconciliation. Barunga heavily influenced Uluru. It was part of the guiding principles. It was alive in the discussions about treaty, broken promises and unfinished business. The political response to Barunga was still very alive in the dialogues. It fed the cynicism of everyone participating in the process. It fueled the fatigue and the disappointment and the anger at us when we rocked up. They will not listen. Why are you wasting our time? Is what we heard over and over again. We had to urge people to suspend their cynicism. We had to urge them to suspend their disbelief that the Australian political and legal system can't change itself to better accommodate their interests. I used to say to them, like Hilary Charlesworth taught me, that law reform is about imagination. So you have to imagine that the world can change. You have to imagine that things can be better. This is what they would say to us when things got heated, Anipad. You have to bear with us. You have to go with this. You have to have faith that the system can change. We spoke about democratic institutions and the tensions in democratic institutions between tradition and change. We know that the referendum mechanism tells us that the constitution was built to change and it can change. We know that because we did it in 1967. British constitutionalism is inherited by us, and it's about tradition and changeability. It can change. Our system can change. Barunga was the driver behind one of the most powerful gestures issued by a consensus of Aboriginal people in Australia's constitutional history, the Uluru Statement from the Heart. As I said, we issued it to the Australian people. We did not invite the Prime Minister and opposition leader to come up and accept those sacred objects with the Uluru Statement. We spoke about the ritualism of Australian politicians going into communities with big entourages of media, accepting these statements, but not quite taking them seriously. Our exhaustion is driven by the fact that the process was lengthy, structured, well thought out, deliberative. It came up with a very clever constitutional innovation. We asked people to trust us. We said, it's okay, the government and the opposition take this seriously. The system is meant to change. We adopted the constitutional technique of decision to defer, to leave the substantive matters to later for the parliament to decide. This we did out of respect for parliamentary sovereignty, as I said. Similarly, the body is an upfront institution that feeds in advice to the parliament and the bureaucracy. It can't veto. It's consistent with our legal and political tradition. We avoided the politics of the courts. The dialogues chose a political approach rather than a court rights-centred approach. These dialogues delivered clever and innovative law reform proposals, as did Barunga before it. So where does that leave us? One thing I would say is I will reiterate, I think Reconciliation Australia just hit it on the head in terms of this theme of don't keep history a mystery. Truth-telling is really important, and I think both Barunga and Uluru emphasise that. As a public lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer of about 15 years, I suppose, who believes very deeply in the emancipatory potential of our liberal democratic system, I worry, though, about the risks here to our young people. My friend and colleague at UNSW Law, Professor Ros Dixon, I think hit the nail on the head when she addressed the New South Wales Bar Association on the Uluru Forum. She said, the risk in the status quo is a whole generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples will entirely lose faith in the process of legal and constitutional reform. She said, I say that as someone who has the great privilege of teaching some Indigenous people who are the leaders of that generation, and I can say to you, from what they have said to me, there is a real sense that this is the last chance. And so that small risk that one runs of changing things with downstream uncertainty, meaning what does the voice look like, has to be weighed against the absolutely certain risk of disillusioning and disappointing a whole generation of leaders and fellow members of our community. And this is what worries me. The risk of this modest reform is significant. A generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians who lose faith in a system that is meant to reform and is built to evolve. Imagine after all this time, my people understand that the law can oppress, but the law can also redeem. Look, rather unconventionally, I am now going to conclude by acknowledging two people here today. The first person I want to acknowledge is Pat Anderson, who I already have, and I know she'll be embarrassed. But Pat was the chair of the Referendum Council, and she's a woman that taught me in 2 years so much about quiet diplomacy and leadership. She combines fierceness with kindness, eternal patience, great wit. Pat worked closely with myself and Cape York lawyer Noel Pearson on the dialogue design, and we forged a very strong bond. And that was not an easy thing because we are three people who come from very, very different backgrounds. Pat is AFL, Noel is rugby union, and I am rugby league. Last year after Uluru, Aunty Pat rang me when I was in Geneva at one of my Human Rights Council meetings for the final Queensland State of Origin when JT retired, and she proudly rang me in Geneva to say that her and Jackie Huggins were watching the Origin in their pyjamas eating takeaway. So I was really proud that I'd left you with something after the dialogues. The second person I wanted to acknowledge is my little niece, Alira Davis, over here, who sledged me when I came up to the stage. Alira is the first grandchild of about 17. My mob come from the Bunya Mountains. We ended up at Cherbourg during the protection era, and then my family ended up in Hervey Bay, and eventually we're all in Logan City, Eagleby, Beenleigh. So Alira is the leader of the Davis kids. They all look up to her. And at my urging, she moved to Canberra to undertake a cadetship with the Attorney General's department. But it also coincided, and I did it because I was close to her, like 1 hour away or whatever it is. But it coincided with my work on the Referendum Council. And for a child who was so adored and loved and surrounded by a mob up there in Eagleby, Beenleigh, Logan City, it was really tough for her. She was alone, she needed help. And I wasn't there for her because for 2 years we were running trial dialogues, preparatory dialogues, 13 dialogues, and then the Uluru National Convention, and then everything that happened afterwards. And so I just wanted to acknowledge your contribution to that, because you also make a contribution to the struggle. So many families, so many mobs do, in the absence of those who are leading these reforms. And I don't say that to be self-serving by singling out Pat or Alira, my own family, because I do it because I'm a constitutional lawyer, and that's my duty to my people, is to help out in those discussions. But I'm respectfully drawing your attention to the sacrifices of our people, the sacrifices that they make in what we call the struggle. Non-Indigenous people often call it civic responsibility, civic or public service, volunteerism. But that is the triumph of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, the ceaseless and unrelenting civic service of our mob to the nation. If anything, Barunga and Uluru are testament to my people's faith in the changeability of Australia's democratic institutions, a testament to many people's desire to make the world a better place for their people, for their children, for their grannies, to identify a complex legal and political problem and come up with an answer. Barunga and Uluru are two frameworks on a continuum. Our people coming up with solutions to what Uluru calls the torment of our powerlessness. In terms of public service, it is my people who punch above their weight. Now we have to work with the Australian people to ensure that our elected representatives understand the innovation behind Uluru and the importance of Parliament paying respect to and engaging seriously with the law reform proposals that came from those 1,200 Australian citizens that also deserve to be heard. I'll conclude by saying, go Queenslander.
I think with the retirement of JT and a new Blues squad will be an interesting origin this year. thank you very much for that passionate, thought-provoking presentation. I think it gave us just some insight into the considerable complexity and diplomacy involved in developing the Uluru Statement, and I thank you for sharing that with us today. Thank you all also for your time. With Professor Davis's permission, we might, if we can get a copy of your transcript, we'll post that up. So thank you, everyone, and have a good morning.